question?
At the end of the program or on the web if you're on a browser.
Oh, okay.
Because we need to keep the lines muted because the quality of the call is really bad if everyone's phones are on.
Okay. Okay.
So as more people come on, you're going to hear a lot more background noise and child, you know, children crying and dishes clanging. Like what I'm hearing right now.
Like now. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. That's one of the drawbacks of this teleseminar system. And also, somebody must have their computer on simultaneously with the telephone. Because there's a delay. There's a 15-second delay. So if you're using the telephone and the web, just choose one or the other. I still hear myself from 15 seconds.
Yeah, it's the other person who just called in.
Okay. Well, that's why I'm going to mute everyone out.
Okay.
Okay. Anita, are you with
yes.
me? Okay. So I'm going to mute everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
We'll start pretty soon.
So do you want me to go to now? I'm on the web and the telephone.
Well, you have to. If you're on the control on the moderator's website, right? Slide.
Okay. What's moderator's website?
Yes.
Right. So you're okay.
Okay.
So when I tell you to, you'll be able to hear me, but I won't be able to hear you.
Okay.
So just
so
when I tell you to,
now I'm
press
on
star
web
7.
And the telephone.
Well, you have to, you're on the control on the moderator's website, right? Right?
Okay. Anita? What's moderator's website?
Anita, press star 7. Anita, star 7. Hello?
Hello?
Okay. You know what? I think that this muting function is not working that well. So can everyone except for Dr. Bola press star 6, please, if you're using a phone?
Star 6?
Yes. Everyone except for Dr. Bola. Someone still has the web
can
and the phone together.
Dr. Bola, press star 6, please, if you're using a phone.
Star 6?
Yes. Anyone except for Dr. Bola.
You have to wait for that to go away.
Hello?
Whoever's on the phone and listening on the web, can you choose one or the other, please? Anita? Dr. Bola? Dr. Bola, can you press star 7?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, great. We're back. All right, so let's get started.
Okay.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Stephen Park of drstephenpark.com, and I'm happy that you can join me tonight for my expert interview series. Tonight's topic will be how to read your sleep study. Just a few housekeeping issues before we start. First of all, please make sure that you're calling from a corded landline, since the quality of wireless or cell phones is unpredictable. If for whatever reason you get disconnected, please dial back in using the same call-in phone number and access code. Please also remember that the content presented tonight is for informational and educational purposes only, and that you should talk with your doctor before making any changes to your medical, exercise, or dietary regimen. Our guest speaker tonight will talk for about 50 minutes, and then we'll open it up for live Q&A. If you're listening in on your browser, you should also be able to see slides during the presentation that Dr. Bola has prepared. So tonight we're going to talk about how you can finally decipher your sleep study. If you've ever had a chance to look at your sleep study, it may seem like a maze of numbers and technical terms. One of the biggest problems that I see is that every sleep center reports the data differently, and all the terms are pretty much identical, but there are situations where certain definitions may differ from one study to another. So to help you understand and appreciate what all these numbers mean, I've invited to our program Dr. Anita Bola, who is a board-certified sleep medicine specialist who practices here in New York City. Welcome to the program, Dr. Bola.
Thank you, Dr. Park.
So can you give us some more background information about yourself and how you got interested in sleep medicine?
Sure. My initial training over about 20 years ago was in internal medicine. I specialized in pulmonary and critical care medicine. I was working as an intensivist in a highly stressful ICU for several years. And I mean both the stress of the job itself and the high acuity of illness of my patients. The patients all had. I did this for about 17 years. And what I did realize is that two things were occurring. Firstly, my work was taking a high toll on my well-being, and secondly, I was spending an entire career trying to salvage these patients at the end stage of devastating, burnt-out chronic disease for the most part. This is very rewarding work. However, what I do realize is that in the United States, we spend vast amounts of money treating not just money but also resources treating these end-stage conditions. But very little time, money, and effort is invested in the causes of these conditions or in educating the public. And I felt that recognizing and treating sleep disorders can have a large impact on the quality of patients' lives, as well as can help to retard the development of other devastating conditions, such as diabetes and hypertension, which contribute in such a large part to putting these patients in the ICU in the first place. So, as you know, I completed my fellowship in sleep medicine a few years ago, and I'm now directing two sleep labs. One is REM Sleep in Manhattan, and the other one is a hospital-based sleep lab at St. Luke's Cornwall in upstate New York. I'm still, however, practicing. I'm a practicing intensivist.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but whoever is on the call, can you press *6 to mute yourself out, except for Dr. Bola? Okay, so we're getting some feedback. So why don't you go ahead, Dr. Bola?
Yep. So, you know, what I was saying was I completed my fellowship in sleep medicine several years ago, and now I'm the director of two sleep labs. One of them is REM Sleep in Manhattan, where I, see patients in consultation and follow up, as well as I read all the studies, interpret all the studies for the lab. And the other one that I was more recently introduced was a hospital-based sleep lab in upstate New York in Cornwall. It's called St. Luke's. And I'm still a practicing intensivist, although to a lesser degree.
Great. And you are practicing in New York City, right?
I am.
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct.
So let's go into the talk. I'm sure that Dr. Bola will answer many of your submitted questions during our talk. But if your question wasn't answered, you can either wait for the live Q&A section at the end of the program or type in your question into the browser if you're on the computer as we move along. As I said, if you're looking at this from a browser, you can see the slides that she's presenting her talk. And I'm gonna, while we're doing this, I'm going to try to upload a link to the PDF document that may appear on your browser so that you can look at the PDF if you don't have access to the web. So let's get started.
Okay, so Steve, my talk today is on how to interpret your sleep study, I chose this topic because this is a pretty intimidating study, as well as a number of patients don't really know how to make head or tail of the study. So I'm going to begin by telling you what the process involves, as well as how to make sense of your sleep study. So essentially it starts off by, the patient going to the doctor or the sleep specialist for a consultation. Most of the time it's the bed partner who will urge you to do so. And it's mainly because, you know, either they're scared by these breathing pauses that they notice, or the snoring disturbs them and actually disturbs their sleep and their functioning the next day. Regardless of why you go to a sleep specialist, I mean, most of the time the symptoms are, you know, patients complaining of snoring, gasping or choking during sleep, breathing pauses, which are also called witnessed apneas. A number of patients complain of daytime sleepiness or tiredness. Occasionally, you'll get a referral for a patient who's actually had a drowsy driving-related accident. Then a number of patients will complain of morning headaches, dry mouth, sore throat. Sex drive may be decreased, and they often wake up to urinate at night. In some patients, the findings are more subtle, such as mood, memory, or concentration is affected. And then occasionally, patients will complain of twitching and jerking in their limbs at night, something that sort of raises a suspicion for a condition called restless leg syndrome. Or patients may complain of difficulty falling or staying asleep. So you go to your doctor or you go to a sleep specialist who recommends an overnight sleep study, which is called a polysomnogram. And this is typically quite an intimidating test. And prior to this, you know, you've been screened by your physician or by a sleep specialist by a number of questions, which involve questionnaires that have to do with your sleep habits, your sleep schedule, you know, questions regarding your snoring symptom, your symptoms, typically an Epworth sleepiness score is looked at, which is a screening test that we use. It's a set of questions of that point towards daytime sleepiness. It's a measure of subjective measure of daytime sleepiness, and you know, you're typically examined by an upper airway exam is performed by your physician or by a sleep specialist, and this sort of begins the referring process to a sleep lab, either for a sleep consultation or for a sleep study. Patients are scheduled, and any special needs that they have during the test are communicated with the sleep lab. If they're referred for a CPAP titration, we need to know whether they've had a polysomnogram performed or a diagnostic test performed so that, you know, we know that the patient actually has a history of sleep apnea. And, you know, the patient arrives for a sleep study about 2 hours prior to their procedure. So this can be a pretty intimidating test. You know, you're made to fill out a number of questionnaires. You're sleeping in a strange environment, which is typically a sleep lab or a sleep center. You know, it could be away from home. And you know, no family members are involved or allowed to be there with you. You're hooked up to wires and electrodes, and you feel like you're being watched all the time because you're actually being video monitored. And then you're woken up early, and you're made to fill out more questionnaires, and then you're kicked out earlier than you would like to. And then a few days later, your doctor or your sleep specialist will give you a call and will give you the results and tell you what to do next. Now, you know, sometimes patients will get a copy of their sleep report. Sometimes they don't. I urge everybody to ask for a copy of their sleep report. Typically, the sleep report is as intimidating as the test itself. And really, my goal today is to try and understand, make you understand what is going on and to make some sense, to help you make some sense of that report. So, typically, the indications for a sleep study, the commonest indications, almost about 70% of patients that are referred to a sleep lab are referred to rule out sleep disordered breathing, which is a spectrum of diseases, the hallmark of which is obstructive sleep apnea, but also involves upper airway resistance syndrome, a term we typically do not use commonly anymore because it's incorporated as mild sleep apnea. And then also patients are sometimes referred to rule out primary snoring. Less common indications would be severe parasomnias, REM behavior disorder, nocturnal seizures, although, you know, typically sleep labs will do not perform an extended EEG montage, and patients who are suspected of having seizure disorders should be referred to an EEG facility and a neurologist. We also perform a sleep study prior to doing an MSLT and suspected narcolepsy, in addition to rule out periodic leg movement disorder. Occasionally, patients will be referred to rule out bruxism, but most often this is seen coincidentally on a sleep study. And then insomnia is typically not an indication for a sleep study, but occasionally in patients who have frequent nocturnal awakenings, where the possibility of nocturnal awakenings from airway collapse is a possibility, we will perform a sleep study. So the sleep study is typically a non-invasive, it's non-invasive, as non-invasive as getting an EEG done. It's a pain-free procedure, there's no pins or needles involved, and it typically involves spending a night or two in a sleep facility where you're hooked up to wires and electrodes, and the testing bedrooms are designed to resemble, you know, the home environment and make you as relaxed as possible. The study is you know, as the name implies, nocturnal polysomnography. It's typically performed at night because most people sleep at night. But occasionally in shift workers and night shift workers, a daytime study will be performed. And then occasionally when an MSLT and an MWT, these are two tests that I will be talking about later on in my talk, when these are requested, these are daytime studies. So for the most part, sleep studies are nocturnal nighttime studies, but occasionally daytime studies are also performed. And then during the polysomnogram, you'll be greeted by a sleep technologist who will sort of explain the procedure to you, typically show you a video or a DVD about the test, have you fill out questionnaires, and, you know, basically start hooking you up to electrodes on your scalp, on your chin, on the edges of the eye, on the shin, and sensors around the nose and belts around the chest, as well as an oxygen probe over the finger. And these are typically connected. These are connected to an amplifier, which will amplify the recording and transmit it to a computer in the technician's room so that they can simultaneously record all these multiple biological functions during your sleep on this digital recording. Now, depending upon your physician's orders, you know, you may be asked to be placed on some kind of therapy, like, you know, your physician may require CPAP during the study or oxygen during the study, and typically they will mention this on the referral form. Some patients are referred to us for a sleep study after they've had an oral appliance fitting, and we will do what is called an oral appliance titration study.
Stop it.
Most of the time, you know, we'll allow patients. I mean, if patients are on medications that they absolutely require, they will be allowed to take their own medications, and we want to make sure that we document this so that we incorporate this into our report when we're interpreting the report. Typically, you're not advised to drink alcohol or caffeine-containing beverages before the test, and we also advise patients not to nap on the night of during the day of the study, because this can sometimes prolong your sleep latency when you come in for the test. Now, a typical sleep study should last about 6 hours or so. That's about, and then after the sleep study is recorded, the data is tabulated by the technologist, and it's passed along to a scorer who is a registered polysomnographic technologist, who then scores the study. And this is an extremely time-consuming process. First, the scorer has to score the study at 30-second epochs for sleep staging, and then at a higher speed to look at any events. And events typically would include respiratory events or limb movements, or snoring, and oxygen desaturation, et cetera. So it's a very time-consuming process. And after the scorer has interpreted the study is then sent to the interpreting physician, who is a board-certified sleep specialist such as myself. And my role is to review the entire history of the patient, their Epworth sleepiness score, their demographic data. You know, I go through the technician's notes, reviewing any abnormalities that occurred during the course of the night, look at the scorer's note, the patient questionnaires, and then basically I review the entire night's score digital recording, which is also called the raw data. Then simultaneously also review the tabulated data and form an impression make recommendations. So the clinical judgment of the sleep specialist is a key element in the interpretation, and it's really advisable that prior to a sleep study, you know, as much as possible, the patient should be seen in sleep consultation by a sleep specialist, because a number of things will actually impact there are a number of things that come into play during a sleep study, which, unless we have the knowledge of, we can't really make, you know, an informed judgment. So the channels that are commonly recorded during a PSG are will monitor the eye movements. These are by electrodes placed on the sides of the eye, or called EOG. There are electrodes placed on the scalp measuring the EEG or the brainwave activity. There's some electrodes placed on the chin, which measure muscle tone. And then there are a couple of catheters that are placed, thin catheters that are placed in front of the nostrils and the mouth, that measure the air flowing in and out of the airway. And this really gives us vital information, especially when there's airway collapse. The breathing effort, or whether the patient has a signal from the brain to breathe or not, effort is measured by belts that are placed over the chest and the abdomen, and they almost look like belts that you use when you go to a gym, you know, these exercise machine belts. So they're all pretty non-invasive and quite actually painless. And the electrodes themselves are almost like small button size, and, you know, applied with glue, and they come off the next day. The glue comes off the next day when you shower. Snoring is measured by a microphone that's placed over the neck. We do a limited EKG by placing a few EKG leads on you, because that's really vital during sleep testing. There's an oxygen probe placed on the finger that measures the oxygen level as you sleep, and this is vital because we want to detect any drop in the oxygenation. This is really a vital piece of information. There are a couple of electrodes that are placed on the shins that will measure, on both shins, that will measure leg muscle activity, or PLMs. And then there are body position sensors that will tell us which position the patient was in and at what time, whether you were supine or prone, or in the left or the right lateral position, or sitting upright. I mean, patients sometimes will actually sleep propped up. You know, you are under video recording, because we do need to detect any abnormal behaviors during the study. This is really vital. There is an intercom to communicate with the technician. This slide basically shows what the hookup sort of looks like. We've got a snoring sound transducer up on the top image. Second image shows a thin catheter placed around the nostrils. Also, almost looks like an oxygen nasal cannula that you use in hospitals. It's quite you know, non-invasive, and doesn't really shouldn't really bother patients. It's stuck behind the ears, and it measures the air flowing in and out of the nose and the mouth. The third image shows the belts that measure the respiratory effort, or the signal from the brain. The last image shows the leg muscle activity. So the stages of sleep, as you probably already know, are divided into non-REM and REM. Non-REM is further divided into stage 1, which is a lighter stage of sleep, N2 and N3, which are the deeper stages of sleep, N3 or slow-wave sleep being the most restorative sleep that we can obtain. And then REM sleep is characterized by rapid eye movements, as the name implies, but also that's really between the eye movements and the diaphragm that's moving, that's pretty much all the muscles that are moving and that are functional in the body at that time. The rest of them are really in a state of paralysis, if you will. So the patient, normal sleep patients will go through about 4 to 6 cycles of non-REM, and typically we begin our sleep in non-REM, most often in stage 1 or stage 2, and then we sort of progress to REM sleep, which first occurs in normal sleep roughly about 90 minutes or so after sleep onset, and later on in the morning, you see more of REM sleep, and this is a hypnogram which shows the normal stages of sleep. The hypnogram is a graphic representation of the stages of sleep across the night, and it sort of visually shows you what the sleep architecture looks like. And as you can see in the slide, where the yellow is a non-REM sleep, we begin our sleep typically in non-REM sleep, and as the night progresses, REM sleep appears, and you see typically 4 to 6 cycles of REM sleep, and REM sort of increases during the course of the night so that it's actually more predominant in the early morning hours. When the study is being scored or interpreted, this is what a polysomnographic recording or raw data looks like, where the top panel shows an extended hypnogram, and this is followed by all the various channels, and the wavy lines that you see in red, I don't know how well this projects, but the wavy lines that you see are basically the flow channels that are measuring the air flowing in and out of your nostrils, so that when there's airway collapse, these become flat. And the blue lines, the two blue wavy lines below that, reflect the effort channel, which is the signal from the brain. The slide that I just showed you was a 30-second EPIC, which is polysomnographic recording at normal speed. This is where we normally stage the sleep stages are scored at 30-second EPICs, and then the recording is moved to a fast speed, and most of the events that occur, the respiratory events or the PLMs, or other events that occur are looked at a faster speed. This is in a 3-minute EPIC, during which you can actually pick up the respiratory events better. This is a slide which shows a patient with snoring. The blue bar across shows episodes of snoring. We also look for apneas, which are divided, are classically of three types. The predominant apneas that we see are obstructive apneas, but we also see central apneas and mixed apneas, and I'm going to go over that in a minute. This slide shows a patient who had multiple obstructive apneas during the course of the night, and as you can see in the red bars going across, the patient had complete airway collapse during these periods. So you have sinusoidal airflow and then all of a sudden complete airway collapse causing cessation of airflow both at the nose and the mouth for at least 10 seconds. So it's really an obstructive apnea needs to be at least 10 seconds long before it can be scored as an obstructive apnea. And it's associated with the drop in the oxygen level. So the blue bars going across are indicate the drop in the oxygen level, and this is typically associated with an arousal from sleep, which is seen on the EEG channels. A central apnea, by contrast, is a condition where there's complete absence not only of the airflow at the nose and the mouth, but also there's a complete absence of respiratory effort. So the thoracic and the abdominal channels will also show a complete flattening, and this needs to be for a duration of at least 10 seconds before it's called or marked as a central apnea. And this typically indicates, as opposed to an obstructive apnea, which is because of some kind of obstruction at the nose or the mouth level, a central apnea typically indicates that the signal from the brain to breathe is delayed. And conditions that we see central apneas in would include, you know, patients who are at high altitude. Sometimes opiates will cause this condition, a condition called Chain-Stokes respiration, or sometimes just for no apparent reason. And here is an example of Chain-Stokes respiration, which is central apneas, but in a crescendo-decrescendo kind of pattern, as you can see from the tracing at near the bottom of the slide. Central apneas, especially of the Chain-Stokes type, are typically seen in patients who have cardiac disease, especially congestive heart failure. So when we see this, we'll recommend a cardiology evaluation, especially if the history seems to indicate history of cardiac disease. This can also be seen in patients who've had strokes or other neurologic conditions. And it often is associated with a heartbeat irregularity called atrial fibrillation. And now this slide here shows what is called a mixed apnea, which is sort of like not as common as obstructive apneas, but here you see complete cessation of airflow for 10 seconds accompanied by a complete absence of respiratory effort as well at the beginning, and later on there is a gradual increase in effort, which eventually will break the apnea. A hypopnea, by contrast, I shouldn't say by contrast, because it's really physiologically the same as an apnea. The healthcare consequences, the physiological consequences of a hypopnea are pretty much the same as an apnea. But it is scored when we see partial airway collapse causing shallow breathing. So the airflow is reduced by 30 to 50%, and we have two different criteria by which we score hypopneas. There's a 4A and a 4B criteria, which I'm not going to go into. But the airflow does not completely cease. It's decreased by about 30 to 50% during sleep. The event lasts about 10 seconds, and you can see that in the pink bar going across. And it's usually it is associated with a fall in the blood oxygen level, either to 3% or 4%, depending upon which criteria you use. And as I said, physiologically, it causes the same consequences as an apnea, namely, it causes a drop in the oxygen level and all the other cardiovascular complications, et cetera, that you see with obstructive apneas. Another entity that I want to mention is a RERA, or a respiratory effort-related arousal. And if you can see on the purple graph bar going across, this is actually a sequence of breaths that is characterized by a decrease in the air flowing. So it's a more subtle decrease in the airflow at the nostrils or the oral airway level. And it's typically it ends by an increase in respiratory effort. There is no oxygen desaturation, so the oxygen level does not drop with this condition, but it does lead to an arousal from sleep. So therefore, it does fragment sleep, and it is included when we're making the diagnosis of sleep apnea, especially in subtle borderline cases. So during a sleep study, we will often coincidentally see teeth grinding, which is named as bruxism, sleep-related bruxism, and it's typically detected on the chin electromyogram electrodes, but sometimes when we suspect bruxism, additional electrodes may need to be placed. Then we also look for leg movements called periodic leg movements. Now, leg movements are not uncommon at all during sleep, and they often occur in the setting of an apnea or a hypopnea, but those are not really scored as periodic leg movements. Periodic leg movements, by definition, are not related to respiratory events. So we look at the total number of periodic leg movements of sleep These are typically detected from the right and the left shin electrodes. And these movements typically occur, they're supposed to occur as a part of four consecutive movements. That's how they're scored. And there are certain criteria for the duration as well as the frequency of these movements that enable them to be labeled as periodic leg movements. We also come up with what is called a PLM index, which is the number of PLMs that are detected per hour of sleep. And typically, a number greater than 15 per hour is what is considered significant. Now, PLMs will often cause arousal. So a PLM arousal index would be PLMs that are associated with arousals per hour of sleep. And these are typically what we take more seriously. During a sleep study, it's not uncommon to see PLMs. Very often, if the patient is not symptomatic and all you see is a high number of PLMs, but the PLM index is less than 15 and the PLM arousal index is insignificant, we will ignore these. PLMs in general can be seen when we're doing a CPAP titration, and often enough they will dissipate, upon further CPAP titration with further CPAP use. But PLMs can also be seen in a condition called restless leg syndrome, where 80% PLMs can be seen in patients with restless leg syndrome. And then often enough, they're seen secondary to medications such as antihistamines or antidepressants or just medications that we commonly sort of use, or secondary to nicotine or alcohol use. But it's important to sort of note these and try and correlate it with whether the patient has symptoms of twitching and jerking in their legs or not. We look at EEG abnormalities especially related to things like every once in a while we'll notice a condition called alpha intrusion, which is seen on the EEG. Brainwave activities that are superimposed on normal brainwave activities that can be seen in pain syndromes or fibromyalgia. Occasionally you'll see seizure waveforms. Via the video monitoring, you can detect behavioral abnormalities such as sleep talking, and the tech will often write in their notes that the patient was noted to be sleep talking. And then another indication for a sleep study is to look for parasomnias, which are undesirable movement or verbal phenomenon that arise from the sleep or the sleep-wake transition. And common examples of these that occur out of non-REM sleep are confusional arousals or night terrors. REM sleep behavior disorder is a parasomnia that occurs during REM sleep where there's increased muscle activity which isn't supposed to be there, and I'll go over that in a minute. And here's a polysomnogram epic of a patient who was noted to have seizures during sleep. This is a patient who was noted to have REM behavior disorder, was characterized by frequent violent nighttime awakenings. This is what the patient complained of, and he would enact his dreams out and flail his limbs during sleep. And this condition can often be quite injurious to the bed partner. This can often be detected by placing some additional leads if you suspect the condition during a sleep study. Changing gears here, I'm going to now move on to a review of some of the numbers that you see on a sleep report. Because so far what I've shown you, all these lovely pictures, had to do with what I look at on the raw data. So basically what you look at on your sleep study is, let's begin with sleep statistics. So some of the numbers you're going to see are lights out, lights on. So essentially, what lights on basically stands for is this is when your study was begun, and this is when you first attempt to fall asleep. Prior to this, the technician will perform biocalibrations, and all the artifacts that may be present are corrected. Lights on indicates the end of the study, which is in the morning when the technician enters your room to wake you up. And at that point, more calibrations are performed. The total recording time is the total time in minutes from lights out to lights on. That is from the beginning of the recording to the end of the recording. So it's also called total recording time or total bedtime. The total sleep time, which is an important number, is the total time that the patient spent asleep. And this is calculated by adding the time that is spent in each sleep stage. Now, sleep onset is defined as the time at which which sleep is first detected after lights out. It's the first epoch of sleep, regardless of what stage of sleep it is. And sleep latency, which is an important number, it's the amount of time that it takes a person in minutes to fall asleep from lights out to sleep onset. Okay, so the number of minutes from lights out to sleep onset. And this really must be interpreted in the context of the patient's history, what their normal bedtime is, whether they're on medications, what their age is, et cetera. So a normal sleep latency would be about 15 to 20 minutes. And the elderly, it could take as long as 30 minutes, and that would be considered normal. Sleep latency of less than 5 minutes typically indicates that the patient is severely sleepy, whereas a sleep latency of more than 20 to 30 minutes would indicate that they're having difficulty falling asleep, either because they're in a strange environment and it's their first night in a sleep lab, a term that we use to describe this is called the first night effect, or they may have insomnia, or they may have napped that afternoon and now they're unable to fall asleep, or they may have consumed caffeine, or it could just simply be a disparity between the patient's normal bedtime and the initiation of the study. I mean, we try our best to begin the study to mimic the patient's normal bedtime, but you have to understand that patients' bedtimes vary so vastly that it's really impossible to start study geared to everybody's, the individual variations. So we'll sometimes see a disparity between the bedtime and the initiation of the study, and if you know what the patient's normal bedtime is, you don't call that insomnia. Sleep efficiency is essentially a percentage of the total recording time that the patient managed to sleep. So it's total recording time divided by total sleep time. And the normal sleep efficiency should be about 90% or greater. In the elderly, it's about 70 to 80%. When patients come to a sleep lab for the first time, sleep efficiency can be somewhat decreased, can be between 80 and 90%. So you sort of have to take that in context because they are in a strange environment. When we see a sleep efficiency of greater than 95%, this indicates a very, very sleep-deprived person, and we try and evaluate for, or it could mean that they may have one of the hypersomnia syndromes and or narcolepsy, and we'll sort of have a suspicion for that condition. The REM latency is the amount of time from sleep onset to the beginning of REM sleep, the first time that REM sleep is seen. And normally it takes about 90 to 120 minutes for somebody to go into REM sleep from the time they fall asleep. But we'll often see this number decreased in patients who have untreated depression or patients who've been on antidepressant medications where they've stopped taking their medications for a while and now they have REM occurring sort of earlier than normal. We often see a decreased REM latency in patients once they get started on CPAP or during a CPAP titration study, and we call this REM rebound, where the REM sleep not only occurs earlier, but you also see an increase in the REM sleep. Lastly, if the REM latency is severely reduced to less than maybe 20 minutes, have a high index of suspicion for narcolepsy. REM latency can be increased in patients who have sleep apnea because their sleep is so fragmented and interrupted that they just about don't even reach REM sleep. Their REM latency may be prolonged, and also antidepressant medications will prolong the REM latency. The next we look at the distribution of the sleep stages, how much time the patient slept, what percentage of time they slept in N1, N2, N3, and REM sleep. Absent or decreased N3, as well as REM is often seen in sleep apnea, and rebound of both of these are seen when you successfully titrate somebody with the CPAP. So typically, a person with normal sleep would spend about 75 to 80% in non-REM sleep, where stage one is about 3 to 8%, stage two is 45 to 55%, and stage three, four, which is now called slow wave sleep, it's actually called stage three now, according to the new rules, we should be spending about 15 to 20% of our sleep time in stage three. And this is really the deepest, most restorative part of our sleep. This is also the stage of sleep in kids where growth hormone is secreted. So it's essential. And lack of this part of sleep will leave you feeling physically very tired the next day. And then about 20 to 25% is spent in REM. Patients who have decreased REM because they never reach REM will report typically that they've stopped dreaming, for example. So what are arousals? So arousals are, in a very simplistic term, micro-awakenings. And these are sort of awakenings that you're not aware of. They're so brief that we can only detect them during a sleep lab, but nevertheless, they will fragment your sleep just the same way as a long, prolonged awakening at home would. And it's typically characterized, we typically call something an arousal at the EEG level, at the brain wave level, when there's an abrupt change of the EEG from a deeper stage of sleep, namely a stage 2 or a stage 3, to a lighter stage of sleep, namely to stage 1, or from REM sleep towards wakefulness, with the possibility of awakening as the final outcome. And an arousal may be accompanied by increased chin muscle activity as well as heart rate, and often enough the patient will also have increased number of body movements, like they'll be jerking around when they have an arousal, jerking in their sleep. In order to call in an arousal, the minimum duration of this abrupt change in EEG needs to be at least 3 seconds. And typically, the causes of arousals are respiratory or airway collapse. But periodic leg movements can also cause arousals. And then there is also this term called spontaneous, where we really don't know the cause, but it has been implicated that patients who have upper airway resistance syndrome would have a number of spontaneous arousals. But regardless of what the cause is, whenever a patient has an increased number of arousals during sleep, and these arousals are counted, it does lead to increased daytime sleepiness and decreased performance the next day, very similar to what you see in sleep deprivation. Look at a number called the arousal index, which is the number of arousals per hour. And this number is very age-dependent, so you really have to take it in the context of or interpret in the context of how old the patient is, so that while it's completely impossible to shake a kid out of sleep, when you're age 20, the arousal index of 10 to 12 per hour would be considered normal. Anything above that would be abnormal. Whereas as you age, The arousal index, the normal cutoff for arousal index increases. So elderly patients will typically have 20 to 25 arousals per hour, and that's considered normal. So it does depend upon the age, but it is a measure of the of sleep fragmentation. So the more the arousal index, the more fragmented the patient's sleep is. And the arousal index will typically increase in patients with insomnia across all ages, as well as in patients who have severe sleep apnea. Most important number to look at is the respiratory events. So we count the obstructive apneas, the central apneas, and the mixed apneas. We also count the number of hypopneas during the course of the night, and as well as their respiratory effort-related arousals called RERAs. And we come up with what is called an AHI, which is a term that you're probably all very familiar with, the apnea-hypopnea index. And this is really all the apneas of all kinds added together with the hypopneas divided by the total sleep time and hours. So it's a per-hour index of the number of times your airway collapses completely or partially. We also look at the AHI in the supine position, because very often the supine AHI would be higher, and the recommendations would be to sleep in a non-supine position or use a snore ball. And then we look at the AHI in different stages of sleep, in REM sleep and non-REM sleep. And again, the respiratory events tend to be somewhat higher in REM sleep, but not always. And then the RDI, or the respiratory disturbance index, is basically apneas and hypopneas, but here we add all the RERAs as well. So in patients who have borderline sleep apnea where we're not sure, we'll use this number to guide us with, you know, whether the patient has sleep disordered breathing or not. The EKG is looked at carefully during a polysomnogram, whether it's too fast or whether it's too slow, a condition called tachycardia or bradycardia. The norms for tachycardia or bradycardia are somewhat different in wakefulness versus sleep. So that tachycardia is defined as a heart rate greater than 90 during sleep, whereas in wakefulness it's more than 100. And bradycardia is defined as a heart rate less than 40, whereas in wakefulness it's a heart rate less than 60. And the reason for this is that most patients, when they sleep, normal individuals, when they sleep, they drop their heart rate during sleep by a certain number of beats. So it's not unusual for a patient to have a heart rate in their 50s during sleep, and that's considered normal. But if the heart rate is less than 40, that's called bradycardia. But what we see most often is heartbeat irregularities, such as premature beats, both from either the upper or the lower chambers or the atria or the ventricles, and these are called premature atrial contractions or premature ventricular contractions. And by themselves, if you see them, they're not something to get really all that alarmed about, except when they occur very frequently. When we see a lot of premature ventricular contractions, that is cause for alarm, and we'll typically refer these patients to a cardiologist, or when we see a bunch of them in a row, a condition called ventricular tachycardia. And it's not uncommon Occasionally we'll see pauses, sinus pauses during sleep. And again, this has to do with the airway collapse causing a drop in the oxygen and a pause in the EKG. The oxygen level is measured both at the typically looked at both at the start of the study, because sometimes patients will have low oxygen levels at baseline. But what's more important is to look at the lowest oxygen saturation during sleep. And patients who will drop their oxygen level below 90, that is really considered abnormal, and it typically will be seen in the setting of airway collapse, because air isn't going in, therefore the oxygen level in the body drops. So 85 to 90% is considered mild, 75 to 85% is considered abnormal. And in patients who have severe sleep apnea, sometimes we'll see oxygen levels drop to below 75%. And sometimes they drop so drastically low that we need to initiate CPAP or maybe even start them on oxygen therapy. So sleep disordered breathing is really a spectrum with snoring on the mild end, UARS, upper airway resistance syndrome in the middle, and the hallmark is really obstructive sleep apnea, which is most often associated with snoring, but occasionally may not. And patients will sometimes be referred to a sleep center for sleep testing, basically just because of snoring. And as we know, a vast number of people snore. 40 to 50% of adult men, 24% of adult women, and 10% of children snore. This typically is a bed partner reported symptom, but the patient themselves are not really don't really complain of sleepiness during the day. When we do a sleep study, we don't see any airflow limitation or flattening of the flow channels. We don't see arousal from sleep, and we do not see oxygen saturation. But the risk of developing sleep apnea in patients who have primary snoring can increase with age and weight gain. And in epidemiological studies, it has been shown that there is a slightly higher prevalence of cardiovascular disease in snorers. So therefore, we do tend to take it somewhat seriously, and not completely ignore it. I'm going to skip over upper airway resistance syndrome. And then obstructive sleep apnea is really characterized by these recurrent episodes of upper airway obstruction. It could be at the level of the nostrils. It could be at the level of the back of the throat, where the tongue just falls back and closes off the airway. But what this does is it leads to episodic drops in the oxygen level during sleep and causes recurrent arousals, and this causes sleep fragmentation. And typically, sleep apnea is worse during the supine position and during REM sleep because all the muscles in the body are paralyzed during that time. So how do we diagnose sleep apnea? So an AHI of more than 5 events per hour is defined as sleep apnea. The severity of sleep apnea is based on the AHI or the RDI or the respiratory disturbance index, so that 5 to 15 is mild, 15 to 30 is moderate, and anything above 30 is considered severe. And as I said, sometimes in borderline cases where the AHI may be 3.8 but the RDI is 7 and the patient has symptoms, we will call this mild obstructive sleep apnea. So now, sleep apnea syndrome is characterized by central apneas more than 5 per hour, and typically the patients will have oxygen desaturation during their sleep, and they will have daytime sleepiness. These are typically cardiac patients, and when you see more than 50% of apneas as central apneas, pure central, this condition is called central sleep apnea syndrome. But for the most part, central apneas will frequently coexist with the obstructive mixed and hypopneas in a condition they sort of lump together as sleep disordered breathing. So when do we treat sleep apnea? CPAP will be covered for adults with sleep disordered breathing if the AHI or RDI is greater than 15, or if the AHI-RDI is between the 5 to 15 range, but the patient has the following symptoms of daytime sleepiness or insomnia, mood disorders, or they have a history of hypertension, stroke, or ischemic heart disease, because as we know, these are comorbidities associated with sleep apnea. And the treatment of sleep apnea, again, depends on the severity of sleep apnea and the symptoms, but typically the three symptom options, the three treatment options are CPAP, a dental appliance made by a a dental sleep specialist, and ENT surgery. And then behavioral modification is really important, especially actually in all forms of sleep apnea, but especially in mild forms of sleep apnea where the patient does not have symptoms, behavioral modification really, really becomes very important, such as weight loss, avoiding alcohol, nicotine, or benzodiazepine, sedative, hypnotics during sleep. And then any effort to improve the patient's nasal patency would also be very important. And sometimes when there is a high component of supine dependency causing the sleep apnea, we'll advise positional therapy. In other words, avoiding the supine position. So what CPAP really does is it's a pneumatic splint, and it keeps the airway open. It's basically nothing but air under pressure delivered to the patient's airway through a mask that they wear connected to a hose, which is connected to a small machine that you place at your bedside. It is non-invasive, and it is continuous pressure during the course of the night. So I'm going to talk briefly about the type of sleep reports that we commonly, the sleep studies that we commonly do in a sleep lab. I'm going to begin with the diagnostic PSG. And here is an example. It's a very busy slide, and I know if you can actually see it well, but this is what a sleep report, a typical NPSG report, would look like. It has the patient's demographic data on there. It has a small paragraph on the patient's history, who they were referred by, what their symptoms are, what their brief physical exam, especially pertaining to the upper airway, looks like, what their Epworth sleepiness score is, what their height, weight, body mass index is, and we especially pay attention to their medical conditions because a number of these medical conditions are associated with OSA, such as coronary artery disease, or whether the patients had bypass surgery, such as in this case. And then what are their list of medications? And as you can see, I hope you can see it, in this page, the sleep architecture box really shows that the patient's sleep efficiency was reduced to 82.9%, which indicates a low or decreased sleep efficiency. Then when we look at the distribution of sleep stages, N3 was completely absent. When we look at their arousal statistics, their arousal index is 40.5, which is significantly high. This is a 52-year-old patient, and typically arousal index for somebody who's that age could be up to about 20, 25, but this is clearly high. The patient has a high AHI. If you look at the respiratory events box, the AHI is 38.3, which is significantly increased. That puts him in the severe sleep apnea range. The AHI is elevated during REM sleep as well as elevated in the supine position. Their lowest oxygenation during sleep is dropped down to as low as 78%, and they only had 12 PLMs during the sleep, which is really not all that significant. And here's the hypnogram, which also shows you that this patient had respiratory events and oxygen desaturation that were worse during REM sleep. So this patient was given the diagnosis of severe obstructive sleep apnea with moderate to severe desaturation and asked to come back for a CPAP titration study, which is really the gold standard of treatment for severe sleep apnea. So a CPAP titration study is an overnight study with the same hookup. The patient comes back on a second night. The hookup is exactly the same as the previous diagnostic study, but here we add, in addition, we have CPAP placed. Occasionally, when I see a patient who's had a poor sleep efficiency on the diagnostic or the NPSG, or if they have a history of insomnia, I will prescribe a non-benzodiazepine sleep aid such as Ambien if the patient can tolerate it, just for the purpose of the sleep study, to in order to facilitate the sleep study, because there's no point in the patient coming in for a CPAP titration study and really spending half the night awake. Most non-benzodiazepine sleep aids do not interfere with the sleep architecture or do not cause airway collapse. So prior to starting the study, the patient is fitted with a mask by the technician and desensitized. They're just allowed to sort of breathe through the CPAP mask at a very low. I lost my slides. Okay. I'm sorry, Steve. I think I lost my slides. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I see it. What happened?
You do?
Go back to slides.
I did. Wish to take control. Okay, here we go. I think
We're
connected back to the server.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm almost done. I thought maybe that was a cue that you're taking too long.
No.
It says loading image. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
All right, thanks. So the patient is fitted with the mask and desensitized to the lowest level of CPAP and humidification. A lot of times patients become claustrophobic when they're first placed on CPAP and they really don't know how to breathe with the CPAP, and that's really important to fit them with the appropriate type of mask. If the patient has any evidence of nasal obstruction or nasal congestion, a full face mask may be what you may want to start with. What kind of a mask the patient is fitted with and how well they tolerate the CPAP titration study is so important in whether they're going to eventually use CPAP or not, because really your first impression is so important. So it's important to get it right the first time around. So once the patient falls asleep, the CPAP is gradually increased, and the goal is to eliminate the airway collapse. So you want to really eliminate all the apneas, the hypopneas, the RARAs, the snoring, and also correct the oxygen level to above 90%. And the goal is to get the AHI less than 5 or even 0 if possible, and preferably test them in the worst-case scenario, which is in supine and REM sleeps, and which is really hard to do sometimes because it's hard to sort of walk into the patient's room and say, well, I need to test you in the supine position, because you'll wake them up. And as far as going into REM sleep is concerned, you really have no control. You know, the patient doesn't go into REM sleep, so be it. So it's sort of hard to, and sometimes we don't get an optimal CPAP pressure during a CPAP titration study. Occasionally, when the pressure requirement is too high, especially if they're up to 15 or 20 centimeters of CPAP and they still have airway collapse, we may need to switch them over to what is called bi-level or BiPAP, where two pressures are dialed in instead of one, where the EPAP, the lower pressure is EPAP is lower than the IPAP, and this enables the patient to exhale better against the pressure of the machine. Often enough, the technicians will use what is called C-Flex technology, which again is for patient comfort, and it offers a breath-to-breath exhalation relief to some extent, at least in the initial part of the exhalation. This is all for patient comfort. And then once an optimal CPAP pressure is determined, you know, the patient is unhooked in the morning, they go home, the physician determines what the optimal CPAP pressure is. We call up the patient, let them know, and we place an order or a prescription with a DME company, who then will send a representative over to deliver the CPAP equipment and the mask over to the patient's house and show them how to use it and tell them how to clean their equipment, et cetera. We also make recommendations, very, very strict recommendations, for the patients to follow up with their physician or the sleep specialist, because this follow-up is really key to, you know, how they're going to, whether they're going to comply with CPAP or not. And a number of problems can occur, especially mask-related problems that can occur after you've been started on CPAP. And on a rare occasion, if we're not able to determine the optimal pressure, we'll need to call you back for a study, for a CPAP titration study. And this is what a typical CPAP titration study would look like. Again, looks very similar to the previous diagnostic NPSG. Here we'll sort of mention what their diagnostic study showed in the paragraph, initial paragraph, and in the sleep architecture box, you can see that their sleep efficiency was 82%. Their stage N3 actually remained absent, and stage R or REM was 26%, which I believe is higher than what they had on the previous study. I'm not sure if it's the same patient anyway. But typically, if the CPAP titration is successful, you'll see an increase in the percentage of REM, sometimes even to higher than normal levels, and REM will occur earlier. And this is called REM rebound. And as you can see in the Restore Events box, the AHI dropped down, the overall AHI dropped down to 2.6. And in the saturation SpO2 statistics box there, saturation, the lower saturation was 90%. Okay, and if you go to the hypnogram, and look at right at the lowest part of the hypnogram where you see a black bar, sort of horizontal black bar, you will see that indicates the CPAP titration. This is the CPAP level, and it's not, doesn't project very easily. And below that is a table which shows the CPAP titration levels. And as you can see, you go up from 4 to 8, and this patient's AHI dropped down to 1.1, which is basically within the normal range. So this patient was then prescribed CPAP at a pressure of 8 centimeters with warm humidification and a large ResMed Micromirage mask, which he was actually titrated with and tolerated well. A split night study, which is a third type of study we perform, but not all that commonly, is sort of the it's a combination of the initial diagnostic study as well as the CPAP titration, both rolled into the same night. And it's typically performed as an alternative to two separate studies if there is a high likelihood, very, very high likelihood of severe sleep apnea, or the patient is reluctant or unable to undergo two full night studies. Most labs have protocols for performing split night emergency studies. So sometimes even when a split night study hasn't been ordered, we will perform one when we see the AHI which is tremendously high or the oxygen level has dropped to a dangerously low level. And this typically, the study will compare the pre and the post PAP data side by side. And this is what it looks like. You can see the diagnostic portion and compared to the therapy portion. And typically you need to have about 2 hours of sleep during the diagnostic portion before the CPAP is applied. And the therapy portion should be about 3 hours of CPAP titration. And as you can see in the diagnostic portion, N3 and stage R REM were absent, and how you see a rebound in both of these, and how the AHI went from 59.8 to 4.8, and how the oxygen level also increased. So this was a successful split night study. And this patient was placed on CPAP and sent home. So compliance is extremely important, and unfortunately, it's very poor in CPAP patients, so that only about 35% some patients will continue using their CPAP after 3 hours of prescription. Use of heated humidifiers and patient education does help some to a large extent, and patient contact with the physician after their CPAP study is of utmost importance. So it's recommended that you meet with your physician 12 weeks at least within the first 12 weeks of starting CPAP, meet face-to-face with the doctor who goes over all your symptoms, whether the symptoms have improved or not, and will have you review your Epworth sleepiness score again to see whether there's any change in your subjective degree of sleepiness. And will often also then ask you to bring your smart card from your machine to download data. And this is becoming more and more important for insurance companies now, who now are demanding that compliance data be downloaded and reported to them so that they can continue to pay for the CPAP machine. So compliance is typically defined by, according to Medicare definitions, as usage of CPAP for more than 4 hours per night for at least 70% of the nights over a 30 consecutive day period, which basically means that you should be using your CPAP for at least 4 hours per night during at least 21 days of a 30-day period. And my last two slides are on two other tests that we perform not so commonly, but one of them is called a multiple sleep latency test or an MSLT. And the indications for this test are typically to rule out narcolepsy or other hypersomnias. As you know, narcolepsy is a condition that is associated with severe excessive daytime sleepiness. Patient sleep is extremely fragmented, and not all, but a number of patients complain of symptoms of cataplexy, which is sudden muscle weakness, such as the knees buckling or the patient just sort of falling down, and this is triggered by strong emotions, such as somebody telling a joke. And this multiple sleep latency test is really the gold standard for objective assessment of daytime sleepiness. And it's a daytime nap test where about 4 to 5 daytime naps are performed after an overnight polysomnogram, which confirms that the patient has slept for 6 hours. And it tests the ability to fall asleep in a quiet environment. So the patient is left hooked up, and you're asked to basically it will test the ability to fall asleep in a daytime environment. And we look at the sleep latency over these 4 or 5 daytime naps and calculate what is called a mean sleep latency, so that anything less than 8 minutes, so if it takes you less than 8 minutes to fall asleep during this daytime nap test, you probably have one of the hypersomnia syndromes and or could be just severely sleep-deprived. And in addition to this, what clinches the diagnosis of narcolepsy is to see two or more sleep-onset REM periods, also called SORAMs. So during this 20-minute nap, if you see REM sleep occurring, that points towards narcolepsy. And then lastly, the maintenance of wakefulness test is a test that is that we perform not infrequently. I've actually actually read a few of these tests, and these typically come from physicians who want to refer their patient for a clearance from a sleep specialist because of their job. So typically, your patient would be, let's say, a train subway operator or a FAA pilot who was diagnosed with sleep apnea and needs to be cleared to go back to work. So this test is, again, a daytime test, and it measures the individual's degree of alertness during waking hours. And it's, as I said, it typically is performed in patients where their ability to remain awake becomes a personal or a professional public safety issue. So a bus driver or a subway operator or a pilot or a ship operator who's been diagnosed with sleep apnea, who has been started on CPAP, would then a few months later, after their compliance has been checked and they've been proven to be compliant, would be brought back for an overnight study, during which the patient will wear their own CPAP at the level that they were prescribed. And this is followed by 40-minute daytime recording sessions where they're actually been asked to stay awake. And if the patient falls asleep during these, that's considered abnormal. So a mean sleep latency of less than 8 minutes is definitely abnormal. And a normal degree of alertness would be if a patient doesn't fall asleep at all or their sleep latency is 40 minutes. So that's good, and then you can clear the patient to go back to work. Thank you. I'm going to end here and take any questions. Thank you for bearing with me. It was a long talk.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Bola. You gave us so much great information. You know, a lot of people were asking the questions while you're talking. Do you want to go to the Q&A or just quickly?
Sure.
Go through each of these questions. I think there are about 7 or 10.
Okay. Should I click on all questions?
Yes, all questions.
Okay. Okay.
Start from the bottom and go
okay,
up.
Okay, I will.
Just
okay.
Really quickly, just one or two sentences per as an answer.
Guillermo. Yep. Hi. So I was diagnosed with moderate sleep apnea with an AHI of 16.3 per hour. However, I'm not reaching stage four of sleep. Stage four. Well, we don't call it stage four anymore. What used to be called stage four is now part of it's stage three and stage four are now lumped together and they're called stage three. So you're talking about slow wave sleep or stage three sleep. And how do you know you're not reaching this? Have you had another study done which documented that you didn't reach stage three sleep?
But I think this person is on the internet right now, so they don't have the ability to talk back to you.
Okay.
This is like
how
an
do
email
I answer?
Question.
Should I just answer it to you? Should I just answer it to you and you could convey?
Yeah. Just answer it.
Okay.
They can hear you.
Yep. So basically, you know, if you've had another sleep study done and it documented that you haven't reached stage three sleep, I wouldn't necessarily worry about it. However, the consequences of not having stage three sleep at all would be that you would be tired during the day, and also the risk of diabetes, from what I understand, could be somewhat higher in patients with, decrease or absent stage three. And in kids, it's associated with, you know, growth problems.
Actually, Judith was asking a number of questions about software for the sleep study reports.
Sure.
She also asked about can they get a digital copy. A lot of people asked about that. Can they get digital copies of their sleep study
reports? Not a problem. I have no problems with that. Okay, so Judith wants to know what PSU software was used to prepare these reports. Well, the PSC software that we use in our lab, I work out of two labs, so this was actually prepared at REM Sleep in Manhattan, and the software that we generally use is Alice 5. And I hope that answers her question.
But, you know, they can get the copies of the printouts, but it's difficult for them to get the digital version, right, because they need the software to be able to read the information, right?
Is that right?
That's my understanding, that these programs are not, even if you export the data, they still need the software to read it, right?
You need the software to read it, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So we use Alice 5 in our lab. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go with Robert Greenbaum. What may be deduced from an AHI of 5.3 during non-REM sleep, but 32 during REM sleep? Okay, so that's a great question. And this actually comes up quite often. So the question is, what is the overall AHI? So if the overall AHI is greater than 5, well, clearly the patient has sleep apnea. But if the overall AHI, meaning REM plus non-REM, is less than 5, and it's 5.3 during non-REM, but 32 during REM, I would say, well, number one, that's rather typical, because most patients do have sleep apnea that is worse during REM sleep. Because remember, your muscles, the body muscles are paralyzed during this. So airway collapse tends to be worse during REM sleep. And often, even if the overall AHI is less than 5, but the REM AHI is significantly high and the patient has a normal percentage of REM sleep, that's important too. So you can have a high AHI in REM sleep if your REM percentage is low. That can be a misleading number. So, you know, if your patient only had 5% of REM sleep during the night, but their AHI was 32 during REM sleep, then that number is, you sort of have to sort of take it with a grain of salt, because that number sort of gets a little exaggerated when the denominator is low. But there is a condition called REM sleep dependent sleep apnea, and a number of physicians are now treating that, even if the overall AHI isn't high. Okay. Should I go on to the next question? Judith has another question.
Yeah, Judith has about 5 or 6 questions.
Okay, so I'm
going
to go on.
Why don't we just give someone else a chance? Yeah. What about Jack? My blood oxygen levels fall below
Jack,
bottom
okay, so my blood oxygen level, right, it fell below the bottom measure of 70%, starting at 98%, and it took 30 seconds to climb above 70%, even after the thorax, et cetera, indicated that the breathing had resumed. 1 minute, 40 seconds and all, is that normal? Well, that's a great question. Sometimes the oxygen level will not climb back to normal, and it takes longer, and that depends upon your pulse transit time and, you know, how well the circulation is sort of moving. So, often if the apnea is a very prolonged apnea, the oxygen level can take longer to come back. But most of the time, it's a circulation-related problem where there is a delay in the oxygen level to come back to normal. Okay.
Why don't we answer Toby's question from New Kensington? What does
sure.
an Epworth sleepiness scale of 17 mean?
Okay, well, Epworth sleepiness scale of 17 does indicate daytime sleepiness or severe daytime sleepiness.
And that goes
because the maximum you can reach is 24 on the Epworth
okay.
sleepiness score. The eight questions, eight daytime scenarios, and the maximum you can have on any of them is 3. So, so from a maximum of 24, if you've got 17, 17 generally means that you're quite sleepy, and you should be evaluated.
And someone asked whether there be slides. Actually, I just put a link to the slides on the, if you're on the browser, the upper left corner, there's a link called Sleep Studies PDF. You can click on that, or you may have to refresh your browser. And lastly, the last question is, what does tachycardia mean on a sleep study if it's not related to REM sleep?
Okay, so tachycardia during a sleep study is defined as a heart rate greater than 90. Now, we do see what is called sinus arrhythmia during sleep, and that's not uncommon, or a variant heart rate, and that's not uncommon at all. And, it, you know, the heart rate sort of varies, becomes slow and fast depending upon the respiratory cycle. So that's not uncommon during sleep. But if you have persistent tachycardia, in other words, if your heart rate is persistently above 90 during a sleep study, I would be a bit concerned. But the first question that I would ask is the patient on some medication that controls their heart rate that they haven't taken today, for example, a beta blocker? You know, that can cause sort of a rebound tachycardia. And if that's not the case and the patient's heart rate is, let's say, 120, persistently 120, and it's sinus, okay, it's not some kind of an irregular atrial fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia, but it's a sinus tachycardia and it's persistent regardless of whether it's in REM sleep or a non-REM sleep and remains persistently high, I will refer those patients to their primary care physician and perhaps even have them seek cardiology evaluation. And typically, if you're seeing a lot of respiratory events or airway collapse, that can be associated with it. But during sleep studies, when we have respiratory events, you can see a variety of cardiac arrhythmias, ranging from bradycardia to tachycardia to SVTs. And sometimes patients are first suspected of sleep apnea based on these. And believe it or not, sometimes patients will have severe bradycardia during sleep. They'll be, let's say, admitted for some other reason to a hospital, and they'll have bradycardia. And they'll actually undergo a full cardiac evaluation for a pacemaker, only to sort of for somebody to come along and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe this patient has sleep apnea. So...
Great. So why don't we open it up, I know it's getting really late now, but when we open up to answer a couple of questions, I'm going to unmute everyone. If you have a question, just state your name, where you're calling from, and ask Dr. Bolle your question. Any questions for Dr. Bolle?
Hi there, it's James Skinner from Nova Scotia. Just one
Hi.
Question. How are you doing tonight?
Good.
Just one question surrounding AHI. It seems to be the value that general GPs are mostly interested, but my concern is that it in many ways is an oversimplification of all the data that's available from a sleep study. One thing that comes to mind is the AHI doesn't incorporate the length of apnea. So, for example, if you have two patients with an AHI of 15, one is having very short apneas, one is having a long apnea, the sickness of that patient can be quite different. Do you ever see a point where a better index could be proposed?
Well, I think a better index would probably be the oxygen desaturation. I think it's unfortunate that we don't use the oxygen or the drop in the oxygenation level as a measure of severity, because I think that's really what the culprit is in causing most of the comorbidities. But the length of the apnea may or may not necessarily correlate with the degree of desaturation.
Right. I have sleep apnea myself, and I've noticed I monitor the data that comes from the machine,
uh-huh.
and one of the things it records is the total time in apnea over the night, and I find that correlates a lot better to how I feel than, you know, just the AHI itself, because, you know,
correct.
The length.
So what you're saying is, so when you have a longer apnea, you don't feel as good the next day.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. You know, I don't know if. Of any literature right now, but again, it doesn't mean it isn't out there, that would look at the length of the apnea. I mean, we would like to think of, well, the longer the apnea, the worse, you know, your desaturation, and therefore the worse you should feel, but it doesn't always work that way. But I think that is a good correlation. But I think there is a move towards looking at the oxygen level, the actual drop in the oxygen level. And perhaps correlating it, or even correlating other physiological variables, autonomic variables such as the heart rate change, or the blood pressure change. Right now, we don't do blood pressure monitoring during sleep studies, but that would be a good thing to look at too.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Anyone else?
*6 to come back online.
Oh, I guess if you're muted, I unmuted everyone, but you may have to press *7 to unmute yourself. We're having some problems with the muting-unmuting function. Let me unmute everyone again.
Maybe *7.
Okay. Anyone have a question?
Dr. Bola?
Hi.
Hi, excellent presentation. This is Joan from South Carolina.
Hi, Joan. How are you?
Well, trying to get my sleep. I'm newly diagnosed with severe obstructive sleep apnea, and I also have severe cardiac microvascular dysfunction. My question, and I've submitted a couple of them, but one that's just a curiosity to me, is that should I use the CPAP, which I've only been on for 1 week, if I felt like taking a nap during the day?
Yes, you absolutely should. Absolutely. You should be wearing CPAP at any time when you're asleep.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, I guess you answered all their questions.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I know some people that have mild sleep apnea, or severely tired and can hardly make it through the day, and they can't even work sometimes. And then I know other people that have severe sleep apnea, and they don't feel tired at all or very lightly tired. Why is that?
Well, one of the reasons for that could be that daytime sleepiness is not just dependent upon the sleep apnea per se and the sleep fragmentation that sleep apnea causes, but on a number of other sleep disorders, such as the patient with mild sleep apnea should really look at their sleep hygiene, you know, how many hours they're sleeping in bed, whether they have any other sleep disorders, such as restless leg syndrome, which can actually cause sleep fragmentation. So they
everything has been ruled out for this person, and they've seen over 60 doctors, and their hygiene is great. And,
uh-huh.